From the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, this is Democracy Now! With the convention set to begin this evening, we bring you the protests, the parties, and a preview of the week. Also, what were Bob Dole and Jack Kemp saying to black journalists this weekend?
Secretary Kemp, after two decades of cultivating an image as a semi-soul brother in the Republican Party, what credibility do you now have with African-American voters after reversing your stand on affirmative action in merely 2 days?
We'll find out what Bob Dole had to answer. And race and politics in Mayor Daley's Chicago. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman here in the Convention Center, actually right outside of it in the Pavilion in Chicago. I'm joined by our national affairs correspondent Larry Bensky and Salim Wakil, our co-host who actually lives here in Chicago all year round. He's senior editor at In These Times and a columnist with the Chicago Sun-Times. Well, the Democrats are kicking off their big nominating, or some would say coronation, party today in Chicago, although the opening session begins with some formal party business, except a big close tonight. Highlights include a primetime speech by actor Christopher Reeve, who's paralyzed and confined to a wheelchair because of an equestrian accident. Gun control advocate Sarah Brady will also address convention delegates. Her husband James was shot during the 1981 assassination attempt on his boss, former President Reagan. Other speakers will include Senator Tom Daschle, Congressmember Dick Gephardt, and Alma Brown, whose husband, Commerce Secretary Ron Brown, was killed earlier this year in a plane crash in Croatia. The Democratic Party's only living ex-president, Jimmy Carter, is missing his first national convention since leaving office in 1981. Carter announced August 9th he would not attend. He didn't disclose why, but said he'd assured President Clinton of his support. Well, although the convention is opening tonight, a lot of things have been happening over the weekend, particularly protests, yes, in Grant Park, the site of major protests in 1968, but also just all around Chicago. And among those who have been out there are Dr. Quentin Young. He's with Physicians for a National Health Plan, which is holding a 24-hour vigil outside the convention calling for universal health care.
About a half a mile away from here, starting its deliberations tomorrow, the Democratic Party. It's our concern that they have fallen back from a commitment to national health insurance, universal national health insurance. This fear is born not out of any paranoia, we got enough of that, but out of the fact that their platform, as presented, eliminates the word universal. This is an ominous development. We want to change that. We all know, everybody in this audience knows, that the American people want that kind of reform. Every time they're polled, they say yes. Meanwhile, the politicians have denied them that. We cannot let that happen. Not only because it's not the right thing to do, applaud away, that's worth an applause, but it's the only thing to do. We are on the threshold of a decline in the living, in the health standards of the American people. That's not rhetoric. There is already some ominous signs from public health data that the most vulnerable sectors are losing life expectancy and experiencing things that shouldn't happen in a country that spends $1 trillion a year on health care.
Dr. Quentin Young is a well-known activist physician here in Chicago. And by the way, Physicians for a National Health Plan will be protesting right outside the convention as opposed to the protest pen because they sued the city. And they are able to get something like 20 spots, which I think, Larry and Salim, that they will be sharing with a number of other protest groups so that at least some delegates will get to see there are protesters here at the Democratic Convention.
Right, but they won't get to see very many of them because it is limited to 20. 20 people can hand out leaflets, wave at the delegates, hold up pictures of bloody fetuses and all the other things we've come to expect outside of conventions. However, the protest pen here, Amy, is downtown in Grant Park, which is about 3 miles away. So very few delegates who don't actually seek it out will see it.
And Dr. Young was very responsible for allowing the protest to be in closer proximity. It was him. And he was very prominent incidentally, in the 68th convention, he was administering to the wounded who were attacked by the Chicago police force. So he's been in the struggle for a while, well, very consistent.
I agree with him. Freedom of speech is healthy. Well, you know, this weekend there have been a number of protests, and there are themes to the protests in Grant Park every day. But this weekend, among the protests were marches that came together, different groups of people coming together, activists from Madison, Wisconsin, a number of Chicago activists here, people who have come from around the country. And on Saturday, there was a group of 22 protesters who were arrested in a scuffle with police during a demonstration against President Clinton's welfare reform bill, the one that he signed, and also just in general against racism.
My name is Bonnie Bluestein. I'm with Progressive Labor Party. Yesterday afternoon, we held a march starting at Madison and Pulaski, a march to protest the fascist policies of welfare cutbacks and attacks on immigrants and all the other crap that Clinton has helped the Republicans get away with. We had a permit for this march. However, the police, in connection with the Lyndon LaRouche people, did their best to disrupt it. The LaRouche people pointed out who they wanted arrested, and the Chicago cops followed their orders and pulled those people out of the line of a legal march. When that did not succeed in disrupting the march, the police went wild. They arrested 22 people, 16 on misdemeanors, 6 are being held on felony charges.
That has the virtue of bringing us up to date on a struggle which I'm sure everyone except possibly the FBI has completely forgotten about, and that is the battle on the far fringes of the far left between progressive labor and the forces of Lyndon LaRouche. I had no idea the Progressive Labor Party even still existed. Is that a major factor here in Chicago, Sonia?
Well, I think the Clinton administration probably recruited them to demonstrate his centrist sensibilities. So if someone's on the left calling him a fascist, then he can't be all bad.
What does that mean about Wednesday, though? There will be significantly more people than were on this march this weekend, marching on the convention center led by the Reverend Al Sharpton and other people. Are those also people you think from Clinton Central Casting, so
no.
You can point out and say, ha ha,
well, he
those
was,
are those welfare people.
I think that will be their tactic, of course, but no, I think, you know, Clinton is going to acknowledge their dissent. You know, he's going to acknowledge their discomfort with his stance on welfare. So I don't think they're going to be that embarrassing, but there are going to be a lot of people who will be demonstrating and, you know, out of their righteous indignation about what's happening and the fact that we are still, African-Americans especially, are still being taken for granted by the Democrats.
And you know, while President Clinton may think that this is a good photo opportunity on the outside, just as he, as we said last week, he stood in front of a chain gang of African Americans and posed with Senator Sam Nunn when he was running for president in 1992. In fact, he is concerned about dissent on the inside. And this weekend, Donna Shalala was out, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, trying to calm discontent over President Clinton's signing of the law that ends 60 years of guaranteed federal cash aid to the poor. And she was out there, for example, with the New York delegation. In particular, they are concerned about the New York delegation. A lot of the activists in that delegation are very upset over the issue of welfare. And I was looking at an AP piece, Associated Press piece, that says more than a quarter of nearly 200 delegates interviewed since Clinton signed the welfare measure last week say he was wrong, but only a few of those interviewed by the Associated Press said they would not work for Clinton's reelection.
Yeah, but look who the delegates are. It's really important. The class base of who the delegates are at this Democratic Party, only 8% of the delegates make less than $30,000 a year. Only 2% of the delegates make less than $20,000 a year. So although they've come a long way, only 8% of the delegates make less than $30,000 a year, and only 2% of the delegates make less than $20,000 a year. Now, they've done much better over the years in getting more racial balance as far as the delegates go to represent who's in the party, but they do terribly on class basis and they do terribly on age basis as well. Whereas, for example, 18% of the voters in the country who vote Democratic are 29, only 6% of the delegates are under 29. So you have something here that's skewed towards the voting class, the older, wealthier, whiter people. And I don't think those are the type of people who are going to be marching up and down in the convention aisles protesting anything.
Right. I agree with that.
You know, there is going to also be a youth convention this week, and we'll be covering that later in the week. In addition to the delegates that are inside, are going to be in the convention center, the United Convention Center here where the Chicago Bulls play and which is opening tonight. The delegates this weekend have been feted by the corporations. And yesterday I had a chance to go over to, I think you call it Scoozies. Is that right, Celine?
That's what it's called.
I don't know. At the end I was talking about it as Scuzzies because there we were, the journalists, outside this fancy Italian restaurant. It was Philip Morris, once again, which brought us much of the Republican convention, there feting the Kentucky and Virginia delegations. And we're going to bring more to our listeners on that issue, the issue of tobacco here and overall big money at the Democratic as well as Republican conventions. But I had a chance to talk to the Kentucky Governor, Paul Patton. He has just been asked to speak. I think he's going to be speaking on Thursday night. Now, why is that? He is a tobacco governor. And since President Clinton has talked about regulating tobacco now as a drug and putting limitations on advertisements to youth around tobacco, he is now trying to counter that, ameliorate some of the problems that are going to be caused, especially in the tobacco states, by bringing Paul Patton in. And I asked him if he thought nicotine was addictive. He said yes. I asked him if he thought tobacco causes cancer. And he said yes, but he doesn't think the FDA should be dealing with that. He thinks Congress should. So there are parties that are happening constantly. We'll be covering those parties as well as the protests. And yesterday, talking about parties, there was one that dealt with today, which is August 26, 1996. Today is the 76th anniversary of women getting the right to vote. I don't know if you knew this was such a significant date, guys, but it is. And there was a party called From Suffragists to Senators, Women Celebrating the Power of the Vote. The keynote speaker was Illinois Senator Carol Moseley Braun.
Dr. Martin Luther King one time referred to the Declaration of Independence as a declaration of intent, because as the history tells us, when it was written, African Americans were disenfranchised and counted as three-fifths of a person for purposes of the census, and women were not counted at all. The struggle for suffrage was as heroic a struggle as the struggle for emancipation and civil rights. Women challenged the existing order and won, and in so doing, helped to reach the ideals that had been so nobly set out in that Declaration of Independence and in our Constitution. And yet, in spite of that struggle, in spite of the jailings and the force feedings of the time, in spite of the presidential disdain and the popular ridicule that many of the suffragists suffered, many women, all too many women, forget and have forgotten, or worse yet, don't know the power and the responsibility that participating in this democracy entails.
And that was Senator from Illinois, Carol Moseley Braun, who's going to be a major figure this week in the convention, talking about women's right to vote 76 years ago. It was gotten today. But Moseley Braun has been involved with quite a controversy over the last few weeks, and that has been a trip that she took to Nigeria. She called it a private trip. She had hoped to keep it secret. And it was her visit with the military dictator's family there, Sonny Abacha. And after she honored women and talked about how we have to celebrate women getting the right to vote, I had a chance to ask her a question about that trip. Senator Moseley Braun, you're here celebrating the broadening of democracy in this country, giving the women the right to vote 76 years ago. But what about your trip to Nigeria, where you visited the family of the military dictator who has 7,000 political opponents in jail, oversaw the killing of Ken Saro-Wiwa? Why did you visit his family?
I've already said all that I'm going to say about that issue.
Well, since we didn't get it, why did you visit?
Well, then there's a tape of it that I can make available.
Why did you? I mean, today this is certainly a significant issue on the issue.
I can, again, we can make the tape available to you. I've said all I'm going to say on that.
These people here are among your strong supporters, obviously.
Well, I'm glad.
Okay. Are they asking you about the Nigerian trip?
I've said all that I'm going to say about this issue. I mean, I really have.
And that is Illinois Senator Carol Moseley Braun. In addition to Larry Venske and Salim Wakil, we're joined by Derek Jackson, and he's a columnist with the Boston Globe and has been writing a few columns on the issue of Nigeria. It's an issue that has gotten some attention outside of Chicago, Carol Moseley Braun's trip, but the Chicago Sun-Times and the Chicago Tribune have certainly been playing it up. Derek, what was your reaction when you heard about Carol Moseley Braun's trip to Nigeria to support the military dictatorship there?
No, it was very disappointing. It was stupid, to be blunt. I mean, the evidence of the abuses of the Nigerian government are so well documented and irrefutable that African Americans or anybody to go there, you can criticize, in fact, the Clinton administration for not taking sanctions seriously. What's interesting about that issue is that Nigeria is on a massive campaign, publicity campaign, particularly interesting among African Americans. They sponsored a black magazine and newspaper publishers to go on a trip there back in the winter, and they came back with these glowing reviews of the government. And of course, Farrakhan went as well. And so it's a situation which is very sad to see so many intelligent people not take this seriously.
Salim, she gets a very bad press here in Chicago, not only for this, but for a lot of other things. She's had four chiefs of staff in her office in 4 years. She has a huge campaign finance scandal bubbling and brewing with 9,600 pages of supplementary documents that have had to be filed. Are we seeing a one-term senator?
It looks that way. You know, and one of the, you know, the tragic aspect of the, what makes this trip to Nigeria even more tragic is that it appears that it was done at the behest of her former fiance, a guy named Cozy Matthews, who has a contract with the Nigerian government.
He's a paid lobbyist, indeed.
And she claimed to have severed all ties with this guy. But it appears that this was a date in Africa. I mean, a very expensive date. It cost her $6,000 or something to go, and it is enormously disappointing.
Now we're going to have to see what happens here at this convention. This was going to be kind of a coronation. Bill Clinton was very anxious to get close to her back in 1992. Here she is on her home turf in Illinois. She was going to play a leading role in front of the podium. Do you think they're still going to let her stand up there in prime time?
I think they have no choice, but there's going to be a lot of whispers, and it's really, you know, to have her do this is the ultimate of stupidity on her part, but also some of the reaction is a bit hypocritical. A lot of these people could care less about Nigeria, and now they're so excised about Carol Moseley Braun giving comfort to these dictators.
You know, I think that's interesting, Salim, because they sent Bill Richardson, the Democrat from New Mexico, to Nigeria right after her, and the State Department chided her and said she should have been briefed before and this is not our policy. Yet, I mean, the Democrats are very good at dancing with dictators. You have President Clinton's close embrace of Suharto, one of the worst dictators
Absolutely.
In the world of Indonesia, and this is, you know, pretty much business as usual. So I think that hypocrisy is very important to point out. Carol Moseley Braun has a very busy schedule this week, and she is being very closely monitored with handlers and everything. Yesterday, when I got a chance to talk to her, I was lucky I got that chance because they were saying she won't be talking to reporters. She'll be having all sorts of parties brought to us by all sorts of corporations. Tonight, she'll be hosting a party for retiring Illinois Senator Paul Simon. And these parties are brought to you by Bank America. She does serve on the banking committee, brought to you by Arthur Anderson and a number of others. But she doesn't want to be exposed to the press, though she wants a lot of press. There's no question about that this week. And she has been asked to speak, although the Democrats are a little queasy about what's going on right now with her and her relationship with Nigeria. I should add that while the Congressional Black Caucus has been pushing the Nigeria Democracy Act, Senator Carol Moseley Braun has been opposing it, one of the few within the Congressional Black Caucus. So,
but in fairness to Senator Moseley Braun, she is hardly the only person throwing parties here, sponsored by multinational corporations that are bringing in hundreds of thousands of dollars. Everybody is doing it. And just like in San Diego, Amy, what are the delegates doing all day? Well, basically, some of them are playing golf, which they pay to do, and that goes into a party fund sponsored by corporations. And others are off at fundraisers, morning, noon, and night, starting at early morning at breakfast. Millions and millions of dollars will be fundraised here in Chicago. We'll talk about that during the week.
You know, it's interesting. I was asking a Virginia delegate why she thinks the corporations bring you these parties. She said, "You think we're that stupid that they could buy our vote with some spaghetti?" This was at Scoozie's last night. I said, "Well, why do you think they're doing it?" And, Governor Paul Patton of Kentucky said, "Because they're good corporate citizens."
Derek, what about the Massachusetts delegation? Where are they getting their money from this time?
Oh, the same place everybody else is.
What are the big Massachusetts players in funding of campaigns for John Kerry, for example?
I'm not really all that sure of all the details of that.
But that is one of his roles here, is to raise money for his campaign against William Weld.
They're no different. But the interesting thing about Weld and Kerry is that they agreed to the $6.9 million spending cap on their own campaigns, which has been praised by the New York Times as something that to take note of. But $6.9 million spending cap is not exactly cornflakes.
And one of the ironies in Chicago is that Republican officials, well-ensconced Republican corporate officials are the ones who are coughing up the dough for the Chicago extravaganza.
You know, we're going to continue this discussion, and we're going to ask Derek Jackson what he had to say to Bob Dole and Jack Kemp, who, unlike President Clinton during the Republican convention, are not on vacation. They are actively campaigning around the country. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Larry Bensky, Salim Wakil, and Derek Jackson. We'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. We're broadcasting live out of the, well, right next door to the United Convention Center, where the Democratic National Convention begins tonight. We're in one of the press pavilions, which cost millions of dollars to construct in the last few weeks. I'm here with Larry Bensky, our national affairs correspondent, Salim Wakil, senior editor at In These Times, and we're with Derek Jackson, who is with the Boston Globe and actually just came in because he was in Nashville this weekend covering the, well, part of the National Association of Black Journalists. And lo and behold, who showed up but Bob Dole and Jack Kemp. Bob Dole actually apologized, didn't he, Derek, for not going to the NAACP and addressing them?
Yes, although he did say, "I apologize for not knowing," which is a ludicrous kind of statement as well.
Especially since at the time he said that he thought Kwesi Mfume, head of the NAACP, was a liberal Democrat, and that he wasn't going to get a that he felt he would get a hostile reception there. So
right. I think that the interesting thing about Dole's appearance is that he did make, I think, in his own way, a sincere attempt to say that he could relate, at least in terms of having fought in World War II. And saying that, talking about, you know, blood transfusions and all that, didn't matter where it came from. However, it's pretty fascinating to watch the Republicans come in and try to put a gentler, kinder face on their handling with black voters, and the Clinton administration here having done a successful job of keeping things at arm's length.
Well, let's take a listen to some of the questions that some reporters got to ask of Bob Dole and Jack Kemp. The first was asked by Jane Tillman Irving, who is a New York-based reporter, and she's with WLIB, a black radio station in New York City.
The Republican platform, your party's manifesto, calls for the denial of citizenship of children, two children born in the United States if their parents are here illegally. For generations, white children of white immigrants, regardless of their status, enjoyed citizenship. Now that the new immigrants are black and brown, would you support a constitutional amendment to deny them citizenship?
No.
All right. Yes. No. So you would be, you, your party, well, your platform does call for that. But you would not support it.
Well, I pay due respect to the platform. I read a lot of the parts that I thought were essential. I approved a lot of parts that I thought were essential, and that was not one of them. I would not support that part of the platform.
You know, it's really interesting to me that the platform, which the Republicans struggled over in public, and I was there for a week, and all these controversial measures in it, not only about abortion and immigration, but many other things as well. We owe a debt to the National Association of Black Journalists. They're the first people who've jammed Bob Dole on whether or not he even read the damn thing. And now he's saying he read just parts of it. It's really extraordinary to me the way the Washington Press Corps and the campaign press corps lets Dole, and for that matter Clinton, get away with things constantly. Did you know beforehand the four questions? That did you sort of conspire beforehand about who was going to ask what?
We did conspire beforehand.
You have to.
And the thing was is that... race had to be part of every question, because it's fundamental to the politics in this country, and certainly fundamental to this appearance before African-American journalists.
You know, it was the first time that Bob Dole said he didn't agree with a plank in the Republican platform. He said a lot that he didn't read it, and that's the way him and Kemp get away with the Republican platform that they are supposed to be championing.
It's not that hard to read. It's only about 70 or 80 pages long, big type. I've read it three or four times.
Well, you have that over in Bob Dole.
Derek, how did they seem? Were they comfortable in your presence, or were they obviously ill at ease?
I think they were somewhere in the middle, actually, Salim. They came in, you know, Kemp, of course, is comfortable, has all along been comfortable. And Dole had, I thought, for his purposes, a decently prepared speech.
Salim, let me ask you something. They're saying now we're going to contest every vote. There's no community we're not going to go into. Mm-hmm. What's going to happen in Chicago if, let's say, Kemp and Dole come to this neighborhood that we're in right now, for example, in just west of downtown, the Henry Horner Houses housing project right here? What kind of reception do you think that Bob Dole's message would get, or Jack Kemp, if they tried a campaign rally around here?
I think Kemp would be received with a lot more... with a lot more of a welcome than Dole. He has kind of cultivated the public housing constituency, although it's been mostly symbolic, of course, that nothing actually has happened, but he has spoken well and not demonized them. And so I think they will be favorably receptive to someone like Kemp.
In fact, unlike President Clinton, Jack Kemp did go to the Henry Horner Houses, and people remember that trip. You know, he is a big proponent of privatization of public housing, and since Henry Horner is about that next door, because they have now a private management team, but he didn't do a lot to back up his ideas.
Exactly.
Now, we just heard Jane Tillman Irving, who's the radio reporter who got to ask a question. Then you had the print reporter, you had the TV reporter. You were representing print.
Yes.
Let's hear what you had to say, Derek Jackson, when it came to asking Bob Dole and Jack Kemp a question at the NABJ conference this weekend in Nashville.
This follow is actually for Secretary Kemp.
I thought you weren't going to ask.
Secretary, similar to what I asked Senator Dole, after two decades of cultivating an image as a semi-soul brother in the Republican Party...
What do you mean semi? Hey, John Mackey, am I semi? Yes, sir.
What credibility do you now have with African-American voters after turning your back on affirmative action in this mere space of 2 days? And does your quick reversal to accept the vice presidential nomination signal that whenever African-American interests conflict with the prevailing white opinion on issues, that African-American interests will just as quickly be thrown overboard?
Well, friends...
Derek Jackson asking Jack Kemp a question at the National Association of Black Journalists Conference this weekend in Nashville about the flip-flop Jack Kemp has done in the last few days as he has become the vice presidential running mate of Bob Dole.
Yeah, I wrote a column actually before the convention, and I think it's a very dangerous sign of that race will be a wedge issue or could be a critical wedge issue, particularly if the race gets close.
When has it not been?
Well, you're right about that. It's always been an issue, but right now you have the situation where the Republicans are, for the moment, putting this sort of kinder, gentler face on their race relations. But clearly with crime, welfare, immigration, all issues involving people of color, you don't have to say people's race anymore. You just do the issue. And you create a huge divide on that along those lines.
One of the things we're going to have to watch for here, you know, in San Diego, they had this whole flap about the media showing too many African-American delegates proportional to who are there. This time it's going to be interesting if it said, well, you're showing too many because there are too many. You should be showing, you know, the more white delegates in the audience. And I think that there's going to be a lot of pressure from the stages of the Democratic Convention on that level, Salim.
I think you're absolutely right. Derek, what did Kemp say?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he said, I'm for affirmative action with a small A, and which is just saying that let's have education, let's have all these ancillary type things, none of which, of course, addresses the fact that many studies and show that African Americans with the same resume are rejected, you know, exponentially more than white job applicants. None of this spoke to job opportunity.
Well, Derek Jackson, we look forward to reading your columns this week in the Boston Globe. Fortunately, we'll get a chance to see the Boston Globe because all the newspapers are available, at least to the journalists around here.
That's the best part of the convention.
Thank you.
Derek Jackson, thanks for joining us. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back with Andrew Hoffman, yes, the son of Abby. Coming up in our next hour, anti-war activists reflecting on Chicago 1968 and their children. We'll hear from attorney Len Wineglass, Paul Krasner, musician Keb Moe, Studs Terkel, Tom Hayden, and Jesse Jackson. They were all at a Nation event yesterday going back to 1968. We'll go back with them. And we are back here on Democracy Now!, broadcasting from right next to the United Convention Center, where the Democratic Convention will open tonight. I'm Amy Goodman with Larry Bensky, Salim Wakil, and we've now been joined by Andrew Hoffman. You know, yesterday we went over to the A Nation event that was held. The Nation magazine held a large event, 1968 to 1996, where a lot of the children and grandchildren of the activists of 1968 gathered to remember and to really celebrate the 1960s. Actually, we didn't see you up on the stage, Andrew.
No, I decided not to go up on the stage. I have been doing political actions here in Chicago for 4 years or so, and I just didn't feel like it was proper to just parade me in front of everybody with the rest of the progeny. I know there are that a lot of the other children of have been doing good work out there, but I had a lot of stories to tell from here in Chicago, and I didn't think that it was the right venue to tell those stories.
So. Whose shirt is that you have on, Andrew? And would you describe it to our radio audience?
This shirt actually is a shirt that I made yesterday morning. It's
looks a lot like shirts I've seen in the past.
Spray painted American flag on a white shirt. Underneath it, I'm wearing a shirt which originally was produced by the Chicago Police Department, which says on the back of it, "We kicked your father's ass in 1968. Wait till you see what we're going to do to you." Little piece of fascist humor, and I took it as so. So I printed more copies because people wanted to buy them from me. And I put on the back of mine, "Compassionate American Peace Officers for a Nonviolent Environment," which is Capone. And I'm asking all police officers in the area to get down with Capone, which is confusing to them to begin with, and then to go on to say "Compassionate American Peace Officers," then they're really confused.
At what age, first of all, your father, of course, got arrested, and they tried to throw him in jail for wearing exactly the same type of shirt that you have on right now. But times have changed, and you see it become a fashion statement now.
Yeah.
Republican as well as Democratic delegates wear garments made out of the flag, ironically enough. But what did your father tell you? When did you learn about the 68th Democratic Convention? What did he tell you about it happened here?
It's... I mean, it's been a part of my life. I was at the Chicago 7 trial twice.
How old were you?
I was 8 years old while the trial was going on. I absorbed it as few people who were in the courtroom did because of my age. I knew even then that it was a very important and significant event that was happening, and that we were showing what the government is willing to do to crush people who are willing to stand up for their beliefs and for the little guy out there, for the soldiers and the Vietnamese people who were being brutalized by a war that didn't make sense.
Well, let's hear what your father had to say, Abby had to say in 1968.
We're 10 miles away, convention hall. You came here to disrupt the convention. They had 10 miles of barbed wire fence. They had 25,000 troops, counting the cops and National Guard. You know? They had tanks, armored tanks in the streets of Chicago. You know? National Guard with bayonets. They had helicopters with machine guns. You know? We came to disrupt the convention. Out of sight. We couldn't find our way out of the park.
You know, I was at the conspiracy trial as well, Andrew, and I remember actually seeing you there and your mother there. And what one of the things I remember about it is that of all the 8 defendants, your father was the one who really got Judge Hoffman upset the most. He couldn't take it when he said his famous phrase to Judge Hoffman, Judge Hoffman, why are you being a Shonda for the Goyim, which means why are you being like a front man for the enemy? And Hoffman just turned bright red. Yeah. I think the Abbey really got under Judge Hoffman's skin in such a way it really drove the judge nuts.
Well, it was a funny coincidence that he happened to have the same last name, and my father never was one to shy away from a good joke, and I've got all the old buttons, screw Magoo, you've seen one judge, you've seen them all.
In fact, didn't your father refuse to be called Abby Hoffman at the trial? He just wanted to be called Abby because he didn't want to share that same
name,
last
right.
name.
Right. And then on the other hand, he declared to the press that he had looked through family records and found out that Hoffman was actually a long-lost relative of
That's
his.
Right. That's right. Julie, he said. I remember standing up saying, Julie, your brother, Paisan.
Well, yeah. Andrew, what's your assessment of the goings-on in Chicago this week?
This week? Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to get to that. I mean, contrast is beautiful art here. It's like the police now, they seem like they're all on Thorazine or something. They've got this sort of demoralized little smile, and they just don't know what to do with themselves. They're riding around in circles around Grant Park on four-wheel vehicles. They don't even have Harleys anymore. The poor guys, I feel sorry for them. I think we should do a reenactment and get 5,000 cops and 5,000 hippies together and have it out in Grant Park, only this time we'll use plastic bats and baseballs. And
well, do you think in some ways the demonstrators won the battle?
I think that the demonstrators, or as I like to refer to the movement as the youth of the world now, not just America, have won the war. We still have a lot of battles to win. We have to fix the environment. We have to take care of the social ills that are plaguing our society now. But I think that because of the communication revolution that's happening, because of the education that is becoming more widespread, that young people are going to take control of their society, their environment, and that the establishment is going to be pushed out, and that we're going to be done with the corporate greed that's going on.
What do you make of the fact that only 4% of the delegates to the Democratic Convention are under 30?
Well, it was Abby who coined the phrase, don't trust anybody under over 30. And then he said, don't trust anybody under 30. I just don't trust anybody. And
Andrew,
but I'm from Boston. I guess that's the way we are.
In a few minutes, you're going to go give a speech. There's a theme to every day of the protests in Grant Park. Today,
right.
It's what? Communities and jobs. What are you going
right.
to be talking
homelessness,
about?
Homelessness. I'm going to be talking about... my new organization, which is dedicated and to the memory of my father, which is called America's Soup Kitchen on Wheels, which is as much about bridging gaps in communities and building a movement from the street, the way my father taught me that, and so many others here in America, that's the only way to start a solid movement is from the streets. And we'll be out there with food and just talking with the people and doing street theater and comic relief on the street.
Does your group have a phone number?
Yeah, I was just going to
yes.
ask that. Yes,
we have a number in Boston, which is 617-666-3646. Or you can get in touch with us at P.O. Box 390074, Cambridge, Massachusetts, 021-3939.
Let's stay with the phone number, 617. It's a lot easier for radio listeners. 617-666-3646 for the organization called?
America's Soup Kitchen on Wheels.
And it's going to need it.
Tax
more and
deductible,
more.
Deductible, nonprofit organization, so we would appreciate any donations.
Help. Any help, we say.
Yeah, and we really want to urge people also to get involved with doing the soup kitchen in other communities. I've been doing it in Boston for a while. I'm trying to break into the Chicago scene with a van here, and I'd like to have a van in any community. So if you're interested in volunteering, call us up.
Andrew, we have to wrap up, but I do have to say that your outfit is quite funny here within the Democratic Convention, because you're wearing an American flag shirt. You've got it over a T-shirt that says, we kicked your daddy's ass and we're going to kick yours now. But you had to wear the credential to get in here. And so
right.
on top of all this, you're wearing your 1996 Democratic National Convention credential, which hangs on a United Airlines shoestring.
Appropriate for the United Center.
Quite a composite. Well, thank you very much.
The Hoffmans and Daleys are doing it all over again here in Chicago. Deja vu.
Andrew Hoffman, thanks for being
with
us.
We could skip the trial this time. Thank you.
Peace.
You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, we're going to talk about race and politics in Daily Chicago. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. We're broadcasting live from right next to the United Convention Center in the Press Pavilion. I'm Amy Goodman with Salim Wakil, senior editor in These Times, and a columnist with the Chicago Sun-Times. And Salim, you wrote a very interesting piece last weekend in the Washington Post on Chicago politics.
The piece essentially said that the younger Mayor Daley, or as we affectionately call him, R2-D2, has managed to have the same effect as his father did with his rude machine and squashing all opposition, especially black opposition. I go into a few of the reasons and some of the history of the city and why that has happened. But since Daley's election in 89, 2 years after the late sainted Harold Washington, who was the first Chicago black mayor, died, There have been six challenges to his position, and they've all failed. And neither, none of the black challengers have seemed to be able to mobilize the vote in any kind of serious way. And we have with us Bob Starks, who's the professor of professor of political science at Northeastern Illinois University and chair of the Task Force for Black Political Empowerment. And we also have on the phone with us Don Rose, who is an observer, longtime observer of local politics. He was a strategist, a political consultant to both the late Mayor Harold Washington and former Mayor Jane Byrne. And he's also doing some stuff with Governor Jim Edgar, so he's bipartisan, I guess you could say. And I'd like to ask you, Bob, why has the black community been able to mount what has been a successful challenge to Mayor Daley?
Why hasn't it not been able to?
Why has it not?
Simply because Daley is a rather keen observer of what I call the individualism, the sort of snide selfishness of the black political elite in this city. And he has very wisely bought off that elite. And
by elite, who do you mean?
Black elected officials, some black activists, former activists who are now on the inside. So he has developed a rather successful strategy of buying off the counter elites, if you will.
How does he buy them off?
By giving them contracts for city, the city's in a process of privatizing numbers of services. So he's given them contracts for that. He's given them somewhat limited access to his office. He's bought them in as sort of pseudo advisors, that kind of stuff. And to many people, unfortunately, that is enough to buy their silence and enter in action.
Don Rose, do you agree with that assessment?
I agree with that very largely. Of course, his father was an expert at buying off
absolutely
at levels of black leadership as well. But Daley has done, the younger Daley, some call him R2-D2, some call him son of boss or SOB.
Well, I call him little, Little Richard.
he's done this. I think
I'm sure the real Little Richard would be insulted.
There's one key aspect, and that is immediately following the death of Harold Washington, there was a split in the black community. And to some extent also the white progressive community that supported the Washington movement. And that split, I think, helped depress the initial surge of movement.
Absolutely.
When Daley first ran. Mm-hmm. And he got into office, I think, largely because of the split. And after that was able to buy off an awful lot of his opposition. He bought off the white progressive opposition in many ways just as perhaps even more easily than he did some of the black opposition.
Absolutely.
You mean by offering offering them jobs within his administration and that kind of thing?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah,
without going into names and personalities, just there was a woman who was once Harold Washington's campaign press secretary who now gets $1.5 million contracts from the mayor from the present mayor for promoting various of his civic enterprises.
What about Richard Daley's brother, Bill Daley, who is also a powerhouse here in Chicago? He's been widely credited with pushing NAFTA through Congress as Bill Clinton's advisor in 92 Illinois chair of his campaign. He's what right now he's the co-chair of the host committee here.
Yeah. Right.
And is a corporate lawyer.
Some people think that, and I think I would largely agree, and probably Don would too, that Bill Daley is the smarter of all the Daley children. He's sort of the godfather, if you will. It's interesting, however, and we should speculate about this, why he was never given a cabinet post in the Clinton administration.
Right, he was being considered for Secretary of Transportation.
But each time he was also considered for a number of other things, but each time he went up, he was bounced back, and I don't know why. But
well, the main reason he didn't get Secretary of Transportation was that Clinton was under pressure at two levels. One, there was still some vestigial concerns about, quote, Chicago machine politicians. And number two, he was also under pressure to put another black or brown face in the machine. In the cabinet.
You said it right, in the machine.
And so he was supplanted by a minority because Clinton had made this pledge to make the cabinet more like the face of America or some such phrase.
Well, speaking of that whole racial issue, there's been some criticism of the black organizing attempt to oust Daley. There's been criticism that that attempt has been too tinged with nationalism, that the black political leadership hasn't been willing to look at cross-racial or perhaps even a white candidate. I mean, there were many people who said David Orr would have been the best choice to oppose Daley.
David Orr
was a former alderman, former, he was mayor for a minute or two after Harold Washington died, and now he's the clerk of the county. And he's a pretty long-standing progressive who has a good reputation in various communities. Don Rose, do you think that the kind of nationalist filter prevented David Orr from being considered?
Well, I assume there are people who wanted a black mayor rather than a white supporter, and that has to be one of the reasons, probably the main reason, why David Orr, who otherwise has fine credentials. So
do you think the thrust for
reform goes in two directions? There's a thrust for political reform, be it colorblind, and there is also a thrust for a black mayor, because we had just lost a black mayor.
And Bob Starks, as the chair of the Task Force for Black Political Empowerment, mm-hmm. that is in fact your position, right?
Yeah.
You want black political empowerment. Would you have ever accepted David Orr? Do you think he would have been a credible candidate?
I think David would have been a credible candidate. The question, however, is I don't know if the white community would have supported David. And that's a question that I don't think even David can answer. I think David himself would say that he would have had a hard time getting a kind of progressive main thrust boost from the white community other than his ward and maybe Hyde Park. But outside of that, he would have been he would have probably suffered the same fate as all the other black candidates that have run.
We're talking with Bob Starks, who is professor of political science at Northeastern Illinois University and chair of the Task Force for Black Political Empowerment. Also on the phone with us, Don Rose, an observer of local politics, longtime strategist and political consultant to the late Mayor Harold Washington. I wanted to ask this question, which has to do with leadership in the black community. And that is, you've got a couple leaders here, which is interesting. I mean, you've got Jesse Jackson, who comes out of Chicago in Operation Push. You've got Louis Farrakhan, whose home base of operations is right here. And yet, basically, you have a white elite power structure in Chicago. What is the role that they play? Do they have any significant power in this city?
Well, Jesse Jackson certainly has power. He has influence. However, Jesse is a national Democrat. He is probably closer to Richard Daley than most of the African-American leadership in this city. He has not done one single thing to criticize Richard Daley. He has been certainly more cooperative with this administration than one would expect. So he is an insider. He has not expressed the kind of outrage and leadership that he had prior to leaving Chicago and going to Washington. Mr. Farrakhan, on the other hand, is an outsider. He's sort of on the outside of the mainstream political stream, and therefore has little influence with the administration. However, I think those things may be changing if, in fact, he gets his voter registration program off the ground and his national convention going. He may, in fact, enter in a big way.
What about this national convention, the convention of the oppressed that he says he's going to be?
The oppressed. It's set for 27th and through 29th of September in St. Louis. But, you know, what I wanted to ask you also, Bob Starks, is assess the Daley administration. You said that he's bought off a lot of black former opposition, but he's also been a rather unique mayor in the fact that he still supports set-asides pretty strongly. He still supports affirmative action. Do you think there are any good qualities of the mayor that can legitimately claim support?
Well, the only good thing is that his term is up in 99, in my opinion. That's the only good thing I can say about Little Richard. Little Richard is a dictator. He's a mean-spirited, hateful, selfish little dictator who has played politics rather well. And it surprises me that there isn't more outrage as a result of that. However, I can say very few good things. Maybe Don can redeem me here and find some good things about Richard, but I can't find very little.
Can you, Don?
At the risk of sounding like a Daley defender,
that's why I said it, Richard.
I can certainly, find some aspects. Right. I think that the important thing is that he has not. You know, if you grant some of the things Bob says, this Daley has been very wise in making himself a moving target. He has not become the clear-cut oppressor that his father was. Daley has been very wise in covering actions. He has always had a black press secretary, for example. He has made some moves that should outrage the community, but he skirts around them and seems to avoid a lot of the blame. I can't say it's Teflon because he doesn't get that many darts thrown at him, or certainly very few of the darts hit him.
And the charges.
He's a very skillful politician in handling the race issue.
And the charges against the charges that people make against him are seldom amplified because the media seems to be quite happy with him.
Yes, right. Well, no, I would agree, and I think Don, in all seriousness, I think Don is probably correct in the sense that he has made himself a moving target. So I really don't blame Daley. I blame the black leadership in this city.
Well, you are a pivotal part of that leadership.
Oh, I am, really.
Yes,
I've been elevated. No, seriously, I have. And I'm really appalled at the fact that the leadership has not been as verbose as it could. This leadership has been more quiescent than I
would have expected. And why do you think that is?
I really don't know. I think it has a lot to do with what happened after Harold's death in 1987. That's about 10 years ago. I think it has a lot to do with the changing political circumstances, the conditions, the fact that there is a massive land grab going on in the city that's been going on for the last 10 years that has displaced thousands of people from traditional neighborhoods and changed the configuration.
And the regentrification.
It really has.
The land grab has been going on for a lot more than 10 years.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You're absolutely right. This is a real estate-driven town.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And that is where race really comes in to the forefront.
How about unions? It's also a union town where the average, percentage of union members in this country is 15%. In this city, it's 25%.
Historically, the unions have been in the pocket of
the
previous Mayor Daley, and
this
remain
one too.
In the pocket of the current Mayor Daley.
That's right.
The unions are, for the most part, not all, but for the most part, the unions are as much a part of the machine as the Wall Street financiers, the LaSalle Street financiers.
Precisely.
Well, so then, is Little Richard, as you put it, Bob, is he in there for life or what?
No, I think Little Richard really wants to become Little Richard the governor or Little Richard the senator or something. I don't think he would be satisfied to stay mayor for 25 years or 22 years as his father did. I think he really wants to move on to something else. And I think he's really searching and hoping that something will come along by 98 to push him out of that position.
He's going to have to clean up some of his malapropisms if he's going to make it. I was just going through some of his and his father's.
I like the way you put it.
Daley 68.
He's dumb.
1968, Mayor Daley said, the policeman isn't there to create disorder. The policeman is there to preserve disorder. Mayor Daley in the 1990s, R2-D2, as you say, said, the more killing and homicide that you have, the more havoc it prevents. Let me say that again. The more killing and homicides you have, the more havoc it prevents. Let's hope he didn't mean that.
Well, no, he's literally true. It prevents less havoc from those who were killed. So he's absolutely correct in that.
Well, we want to thank you both for joining us. Bob Starks, a professor of political science at Northeastern Illinois University and chair of the Task Force for Black Political Empowerment, and Don Rose, an observer of local politics, strategist and political consultant to the late Mayor Harold Washington, former Mayor Jane Byrne, and current Governor Jim Edgar. Well, Democracy Now! Comes to an end on this first day of live coverage from the Democratic National Convention. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin. We had help from Michael Yoshida. He is our engineer, and help from Janice K. Bryant and Errol Maitland. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. If you'd like to call our comment line, 202-588-0999. That's 202-588-0999. I'm Amy Goodman with Larry Bensky and Salim Wakil. Thanks very much for joining us from Chicago for this special coverage of the Democratic National Convention. From the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, this is Democracy Now! As the thousands of delegates prepare for tonight's events, protesters from 1968 gather with their children and grandchildren and journalists to remember.
Then came the tear gas. If you never had it, you're quite an experience. The burning, the coughing. We retreated helter-skelter toward Clark Street, coughing, Fleming, cursing him. Now, I was there with my friend, the British journalist, a very eminent one, James Cameron. And a tear gas canister fell at our feet as we're leaving just then. And this is the metaphor. This is my epiphany. Just then, a tall, lean kid, goofy looking, don't remember his face, but a silhouette, long hair, about 6 feet tall, weighing about 130 pounds, a skeleton of a kid, kicks that canister of tear gas away from himself, away from us, toward himself. That was the moment for me. That kid.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to this second hour of our special coverage from the Democratic National Convention here in Chicago. I'm Amy Goodman with Larry Bensky. And in this special first of our second hours of the week, Larry, we're going to go back in time. We're going to go back actually to yesterday, to a
far back in time
nation event that then took us back to 1968.
Yes, and the voice you just heard in that introduction was that, of course, of Studs Terkel, the legendary columnist and radio broadcaster here in Chicago, who was one of the people who read and performed yesterday. There were about 2,000 people in the ultra-modern McCormick Center Theater here for a benefit sponsored for The Nation magazine. scene. And by the time it was over 4 hours later, I'd say there were perhaps 100 people left in the audience, as it was, in a sense, a typical left-wing political rally that went on much too long and kind of discouraged a lot of the people because they couldn't decide behind the scenes who would speak and who wouldn't, et cetera, et cetera. But it had a really good feel to it throughout, and I think people were energized, and certainly it was beautifully produced, Amy, with a lot of old footage being shown on the screen above. Some of the musicians who played, especially the two members of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young who showed up, and Jackson Browne and Bonnie Raitt, evoked many of the songs of the era. And I thought the most moving moment actually was at the very beginning when they ended a presentation about what had happened in 68 with a little presentation about what had happened at the trial in 1969, the conspiracy trial of the Chicago Eight. And at that point, the final thing that they read was read by the son of Tom Hayden, Troy. Tom Hayden saying, you know, the thing that bothers me most about this trial is the fact that I wanted to have a family and now I won't be able to start one if I have to go to prison. And then Troy came out there and said, you see, he actually did get to start a family, and he was followed by Tom Hayden's daughter and by a whole host of children and grandchildren and surviving participants. Five of the six surviving members of the Chicago Eight were there and on stage with their children and grandchildren.
That's right. Among them, Bobby Seale. And we had Bobby Seale on the show on Friday. You know, for a second there, Larry, when you talked about the most moving moment at yesterday's Nation event, I thought you were going to say Mayor Daley standing up at the beginning.
Well, we have Mayor Daley here on tape. He wouldn't come in on our show live after getting the treatment he got last hour, but let's listen to him.
And by the way, we should say that for this next hour, we are going to be going back to that Nation event and bringing you excerpts from people like Studs Terkel, as well as Troy Hayden and Jesse Jackson, and much of the music that was played yesterday. But first to Mayor Daley, who was there at the Nation extravaganza.
I firmly believe that all the things that I can do as mayor, the most serious question facing us is to educate people in a better way. And the challenges of today are just too great to spend time refighting the battles of the past. We have learned from the past. I hope you will enjoy this afternoon's concert featuring some of the country's most talented musicians, as well as committed. I know you all are committed to various issues, and keep that commitment strong in your heart and your mind, because I know all of us will not only make this country but this world a better place to live. Thank you very much.
Chicago Mayor Richard Daley greeting the people at the Nation event yesterday, where they went on for some 4 hours, and quite a stirring occasion. I think we're going to have more reunion-type sentiment this week, Amy, than perhaps even the media anticipated, although having been here since last Thursday and watching television especially, as well as reading the newspapers, they really are obsessed with Chicago 68. And typically enough, of course, the corporate establishment media is obsessed with the superficiality of it, not the meaning of it. They'll show old footage of people being beaten up in the park, and they'll interview people about the tactics of what went on. But almost completely neglected is why people came here.
And that's why we really wanted to spend this hour bringing people the voices and the people and the children and grandchildren of the protesters of 1968.
Good afternoon. My name is Alfre Woodard. I was waiting back in the wings, and I was having flashbacks because I performed in high school productions of Hair before. And I must say, I realized that I was actually in 1996, because backstage the cast of Hair was doing wheatgrass shooters. And this afternoon, I wanted to say to you, implore you, to give me an F! Yeah. Give me a U! Yeah. Give me a C! Yeah. All right, that's far enough. Yeah. Yes, yeah, look, some of y'all got nervous, didn't you? You were saying it, but you got nervous. We're a little more conservative now than we'd like to believe. The truth of the matter is that that group spell was as close to classwork as a lot of us got in the years surrounding 1968. There was work to be done. There was the business of killing and dying so far from home. There was the business of killing and dying in our communities around this country. There was the business of standing down the machinery of destruction. Many of us were hungry, rattling in deep pain of poverty. Many of us were not represented in the workforce, in the government, at the seat of higher learning. And certainly many of us and our concerns were not represented at the National Democratic Convention. We raised our voices, a collective voice of a generation not defined by age, but certainly by thought and action. But no one was listening. We took to the streets. During the dog days of August 1968, as the spirit rose and the billy clubs danced, the whole world watched. We gather today in a political rite of passage with our children, our young sisters and brothers, to commemorate, to celebrate, to rededicate ourselves to the cause of government by the people, for the people, of the people. All the people. We live in such times that this very impulse is called progressive. It is an adjective to which we proudly answer, Presente! It is a challenge that we will spend the rest of our lives trying to live up to. 28 years and many dim-witted and dark, mean-spirited Republican days later, can we go there? There is hardly a shout as this Congress of theirs and this Supreme Court of theirs methodically strives to unravel every law we hold sacred, every law written on the backs of Fannie Lou Hamer, James Cheney, Cesar Chavez, Rosa Parks, John Lewis, Andy Goodman, Dolores Huerta, Mickey Schwerner, Robert Moses, yours, and the countless strong. Every gain we have made in the past 36 years of social movement in this country, and there is hardly a shout. We have seemingly insurmountable work to do just to make our lives respectable. But we also have an undefeatable army. We have all the strength of the ages. We have our children, gait strong, arms stretched forth, hands grasping the baton, eyes on the prize of this land of plenty, filling the bellies and minds of her children as we usher in justice to take her rightful place at the seat of this government. We will not run this race in vain. A luta continua! The struggle continues, and so do we. We celebrate the continuity.
My name is Leonard Weinglass. I was privileged, together with Bill Kunstler, to represent the Chicago 8. I want to take you back for a moment to a day early in February of 1970. After 5.5 months of trial, the jury retired to deliberate the fate of the Chicago defendants. They were to deliberate for several weeks before returning a verdict of mostly not guilty on 9 of the 14 charges. But Judge Hoffman couldn't wait. He immediately began summary proceedings without a jury and sentenced each of the remaining 7 defendants to long prison terms for what he viewed as contempt of court for their speaking out during the trial. Earlier, he had sentenced Bobby Seale, the eighth defendant, to a period of 4 years in prison for insisting on his right to defend himself, a right which was later vindicated by the United States Supreme Court in another case. But on this day, he was to sentence the remaining seven. And he started with Dave Dellinger and with Rennie Davis. And when Dave Dellinger was sentenced, he spoke to the court in a very moving and eloquent speech in which he said, although he was an older man, this generation was not going to sit quietly while evil was perpetrated around them. The judge then sentenced Dave to a very long prison term, and his daughter began to weep openly. The judge demanded order in the court, and the marshals surrounded her and began to assault Dave's daughter. Pandemonium broke out in the courtroom. There was fighting everywhere. Even the reporters were crying that moment. But when things calmed down, the judge then called for the next defendant to be sentenced, Tom Hayden.
Mr. Weinglass, Mr. Weinstein, does your defendant wish to speak before sentencing?
Yes, he does, Your Honor.
Your Honor, I hope you realize that your punishing us will not have an effect. Even though you sentenced the elder Dellinger to prison, the younger Dellinger still fights against you. So, Your Honor, before your eyes, you must see that your system does not hold together. Sentencing us to 5 to 10 years will not stop the movement any more than beating us with police clubs on the streets of Chicago stopped it. The only thing that hurts me about going to prison is personal. And that is, I want to be a father.
Well, that is where the federal prison system cannot help you.
Hi. My name is Troy. I'm the son of Tom Hayden.
I'm Vanessa. I'm also a child of Tom Hayden.
I'm Tom Hayden.
Hello, I'm Rennie Davis. And for those of you who think you missed the 60s with its passion for life and its love for life, what happened in the Renaissance period, what happened in the 1960s, is about to happen again. An explosion of life on this planet, a passion to live and to be and to create.
Hi, I'm Jonathan. I'm the son of John Friends.
Thank you. I'm John Freund. I can't see you, but I can tell you that I feel the same excitement that we felt in 1968. Today, I'm professor of toxicology at UCLA in Los Angeles. My issues that I do research on are environmental cancer and policy issues accordingly. I think that environmental issues represents the most profound problems of our time, and I think the only way that we're going to address them in the future, in the short term and the long term, is with the kind of energy, the excitement, and the commitment that we had in 1968. We need to find it again and bring it forward into the ensuing days when troubled times will come before us. Thank you.
I'm Stu Albert.
I'm Judy Albert.
I'm Jessica Albert.
We came to Chicago in 1968 to protest the war, to protest the culture of death, and to run a pig for president. We may do it again. I was a hippie along with Jerry Rubin, Abby Hoffman. They were indicted for coming to Chicago, and I was an unindicted co-conspirator.
Hi, my name is Seth Dellinger, and I've always thought of Dave as my weird grandfather, who I love very much, and I love him even more being here in Chicago and learning about the events he's taking part in. So this is Dave.
What can I say except my pride in my children and grandchildren? One other thing, that I have come here today feeling that the society is even sicker now than it was in 1996, and that the problems will not be solved by either the Democratic or Republican parties, but by people changing their lives and their neighborhoods and their communities. Thank you.
Dave Dellinger and his children and grandchildren with their form of family values here on Democracy Now! We're bringing you the Nation Magazine event that took place yesterday, a Nation Magazine benefit here in Chicago on this day before the opening of the Democratic Convention, which starts tonight. We're going to continue with this. Remember, if you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. As we continue on this journey back to 1968 with the people who were there. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! Live from Chicago in the Press Pavilion next to the United Convention Center where the Democratic Convention is taking place. I'm Amy Goodman. Larry Bensky is with us, and we are bringing you the Nation event that took place yesterday.
In an auditorium filled with about 2,000 people here in Chicago, tribute to the 1968 people, Dave Dellinger getting the year wrong there about when things were all bad, but certainly getting the principle right. Still to come, we'll be hearing from Jesse Jackson and Tom Hayden, and many others, including Paul Krasner, but right now the editor of The Nation, Katrina Vandenhuvel.
At the forefront of the charge towards the future is the editor-in-chief of The Nation magazine. As you know, the most respected and widely read progressive journal being published. She is a sister to all and a friend of justice, Katrina Vandenhuvel.
Well, welcome. Tough to follow that. I was not in Chicago in 1968. I would have liked to have been here, but at the time I was 9 years old. And like so many 9-year-olds of my generation, I was still living at home. Let me now introduce a creative dissenter, someone who has been called many things by many people. The FBI, in a poison letter to Life magazine, called Paul Krassner a social rebel was far too cute. Krassner, the FBI wrote, is a nut, a raving, unconfined nut. George Carlin said the FBI was right. This man is dangerous, funny, and necessary. Publisher and editor of The Realist since 1958, co-founder of The Yippies with Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, Paul Krassner.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to return to the scene of the crime. I've been asked to say a few words about the people who really run this country, the spin doctors. We now have government by damage control, and it's very bipartisan. So when the Clintons announced that they're going to adopt a baby, then Bob Dole announces that he's going to adopt a passionate stance. When Bill Clinton tries to appeal to Generation X, then Bob Dole tries to appeal to Generation X-lax. Bill Clinton used as his campaign song something from Fleetwood Mac, Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow. So Bob Dole is using as his campaign song something from Beck, I'm a loser, baby, so why don't you kill me? We have Pat Buchanan, who a few years ago we had George Bush saying, read my lips. Now we have Pat Buchanan saying, read Mein Kampf. Just a smidgen away. Even William Bennett said that Pat Buchanan is flirting with fascism. And of course, Bill Bennett is a friendly fascist. So for William Bennett to say that Pat Buchanan is flirting with fascism, it would be like Charlie Sheen chastising Hugh Grant because he had to pay for sex. So, William Bennett was the drug czar, then he was the education czar, now he's the virtue czar. And when I first heard that he was, somebody said, what do you think of the new drug czar? I thought it was a new drug called czar. And it was, oh yeah, I like it. It doesn't make you clench your jaws. Get me some more czar. And then there was this big campaign to get Colin Powell for president. And it was very interesting because his best qualification, apparently, was that he was articulate. And, of course, he was. Colin Powell was articulate about covering up the My Lai massacre. He was articulate about not having gays in the military. And it was very interesting irony because here was the first African-American head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and you wanted to say to him, General Powell, you know, you say you don't want gays in the military because it would make the men in the barracks uncomfortable if a gay slept in the same barracks with them. I mean, isn't that what they used to say about blacks in the army? And Colin Powell answered, yes, but we never told anybody we were black. And there you had the forerunner of the don't ask, don't tell policy. So, enjoy the rest of the afternoon. I'll see you at Grand Park when, in the spirit of reconciliation, Mayor Daley and Tom Hayden plant some marijuana seeds. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Keb Moe.
Hello, my friend, it's been a while. All our old clothes are back in style. Y'all know what I'm talking. We went our separate ways, only to return to face a lesson we failed to learn, and we didn't understand the truth. You were blinded by the eyes of youth. But time kept on moving, and a change has come. And you think that I don't know where you're coming from. 'Cause I feel just like you, and I cry just like you. But I heal just like you. And under my skin, I'm just like you. And you gave your love and your innocence, and they took away your confidence. You're not those women, and I'm not those men. Put your arms around me, 'cause I am your friend. 'Cause I feel just like you, and I cry just like you. But I heal just like you. And under my skin, I'm just like you and everybody else. When I get hurt, you know I cry for help. And I've got secrets that God only knows. And God knows I feel just like you, and I cry just like you. But I heal just like you, and I break down just like you, and I feel just like you, and I cry just like you, and I'm weak just like you, and under my skin I'm just like you. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Victor Navasky. I'm the publisher of The Nation magazine. Now, anyone who has worked, or anyone who has walked the streets of Chicago with Studs Terkel, knows he needs no introduction. So instead of introducing him, I thought I would nominate him. You get to hear a nominating speech. Not for president, we already have too many nominees for that. Not for a Pulitzer Prize, which he uniquely deserves, but he's too radical for that. Not for a Nobel Prize, that would require that they have the imagination he has on the air in his books and in his life as a dissenter, a person who has devoted himself to the cause of peace and an inspirer of a generation and generations of journalists. I want to nominate Studs, not as a president, but as a presider, a presider over the so-called debates, the televised conversations with those who would be president. It's a serious nomination, and you can all work to make it happen by contacting the various networks. Imagine Studs sitting there, rather than Rather or Jennings or Brokaw or Cokie Roberts and the rest. Consider the national conversation that could come out of that, which is a conversation which, instead of avoiding the issues, which is what the so-called debates usually do, would go right to the heart of the matter. To do that, of course, you need a man with a heart rather than TV hair. And Studs is the only man in the House whose heart has recently survived a quintuple bypass. I give you Mr. Studs Terkel, man with a heart. Thank you. Thank you. Now, a funny thing happened on my way to this forum. I experienced an epiphany. That is, I re-experienced something that happened 28 years ago, almost to the very day. It was on a balmy summer evening at Lincoln Park. Now, what happened at Lincoln Park that night was a prelude to what happened the following day at Grant Park, where, as you know, there was a happening. It was sort of a be-in. But in place of flowers being strewn, the tear gas was there in abundance, and it wafted across the street to the Hilton Hotel, where many of the delegates were staying, as well as visiting journalists. Now, there's a bar at that hotel called the Haymarket, right on the corner of Balboa and Michigan. Only a plate glass window separated the journalists having a drink from the sidewalk outside, where everybody was crying. Middle-aged, respectable men and women, as well as kids gaudily dressed, were dabbing their eyes, hawking, Fleming. It was a tear gas. So the journalists wanted to go outside to meet them, but the door was locked. And the maitre d', manager of the bar, said, "You are locked in for your own safety. However, drinks are on the house." It was a scene right out of Jean Genet's play. Jean Genet, by the way, was a visiting journalist in town. Now, that's the prelude, or rather the postlude, to what happened at Lincoln Park. It was planned that night by a local clergyman called the Northside Ministry. And they hammered together a huge wooden cross, which they carried. They led the procession, followed by this caravan of gypsies, about 2,000 of the young, heading toward Lincoln Park. But there was one caveat. There was an ordinance passed long ago that the park has a curfew at 11 o'clock. It was always honored in its breach rather than its observance, because every night, almost every night, smelt fishermen slept overnight on hot August nights. But on this one night, the city's highest authority himself decided curfew will ring tonight. And so that's what's happening. We went to the park, and there was the huge wooden cross embedded in the grass, and there were the usual songs and speeches, all uneventful, when there appeared, about 300-yard distance, the Roman battalion. Now, if you are romantically inclined and given to fantasy, as I am, it was like a scene out of a medieval woodcut. Here was a little band, call them Christians, if you will, and there's the Roman battalion. Now, you couldn't see the faces of the battalion because the shields covered their faces, but you heard over the bullhorn, you heard the voice says, "The park must be cleared at 11. It is the law. If not, measures will be taken." We knew the measures meant tear gas. Nobody moved. The witching hour. Somebody said, "Those who leave, please do." Hardly anybody. Then came the tear gas. If you never had it, it was quite an experience, the burning, the coughing. We retreated helter-skelter toward Clark Street, coughing, Fleming, cursing him. Now, I was there with my friend, a British journalist, a very eminent one, James Cameron, and a tear gas canister fell at our feet as we're leaving just then. And this is the metaphor. This is my epiphany. Just then, a tall, lean kid, goofy-looking, don't remember his face, but a silhouette, long hair, about 6 feet tall, weighing about 130 pounds, a skeleton of a kid, kicks that canister of tear gas away from himself, away from us, toward himself. That was the moment for me. That kid, in doing that, had a cause outside himself. He was not an MBA kid
whiz kid making the financial pages of the papers of the Wall Street Journal. No, he had something outside himself. He's what Freedom Summer was all about. That kid is what the allies of the Civil Rights Movement were all about. He is what those protests were all about. That kid is what the 60s was all about. Now, you see, before I end this brief sermon, just a word. And the word, we know what's happened in 28 years. We know that a dream has been distorted, a dream has been perverted, a memory has been erased, so we're suffering from a national Alzheimer's disease, from which we are slowly awakening. There was a comment made by a marvelous historian named Joan Nestle, and she said, the 60s is put down by those who delight in the failure of dreams. Now, that dream, it's easy to say that dream is dead. It's easy to become cynical, but I know that kid is still around and about. He is everywhere, one way or another, bewildered, but looking for that something. And that kid is here in the house. That's why you are here tonight. And so as for me, I was honored to be there then, as I am in being here now.
Studs Terkel, yesterday at the nation's benefit here in Chicago, going back to 1968.
You know, Amy, there was no program for that, so people really didn't know who was going to speak when. But what people had to tide them over, if they were bored during the four-hour event, was a free copy of the nation's Democratic Convention issue called Steal This Party. And print junkie that I am, after the 4 hours of the nation, I went home and actually read most of this issue, and I would really highly recommend it to Pacifica listeners, especially the article on economics by Jeff Foe about escaping the budget trap, which really lays out where the Clintonomics and Dole Kemponomics falls down.
And the rest of the people who have written in this issue, among them Jesse Jackson, as well as Tom Hayden, and we're going to hear from them in just a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Larry Bensky. We'll be back. This is Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman with Larry Bensky as we continue on this journey back at the nation's benefit event yesterday. We're reporting to you from the Press Pavilion number 5 here outside the United Convention Center, where the Democratic National Convention will be opening tonight. But for now, we are still going back, and we're going back with Alfre Woodard, Tom Hayden, and Jesse Jackson.
As a teenage girl, Tom Hayden frightened me. He's still pretty scary now, but I knew enough about living in this land to know that if you got too far up into the face of power, talking about significant change, we'd have to lay your body out, sing freedom songs over you, and toss flowers in a hole. I was being taught the radical doctrine of Jesus Christ at Bishop Kelly High School in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where I was encouraged to stand up and speak up for peace and justice, but not to wear my school uniform just in case I got arrested, or even worse yet, get on the news. I was coming of age learning and living American history, our bloody American history as it pertained to me as a girl and as an African, as it pertained to workers, to the poor, and to the indigenous people. I distinctly remember watching the scene out of Chicago and thinking, oh shit, this is it. This is the end. They've beaten white kids. on the TV. I might as well run my black behind for the hills. But Tom Hayden especially frightened me because this young man stood up and spoke the truth as he saw it without flinching, when I thought perhaps he should have been flinching. He frightened me because he stood up and tried to reason with what I thought the unreasonable and the unreachable. I realized then that I couldn't afford the luxury of a life of reacting, of rampant emotions and righteous indignation. I realized through Tom Hayden that I had to work to create the change we knew was just and was possible, and it would probably be a gig I'd have to pass on to my children. Eventually, I had the good fortune to meet and know Tom as a neighbor, as a friend, and proudly as a constituent. He continues to inspire me, to challenge me, to motivate me, and to infuriate me. It can be annoying to have a friend who constantly reminds you how everything you do is related to many other people and their rights and needs and dreams. For me, Tom Hayden represents that steady through line, bringing the ideals of the 60s through to the 90s. And with the intelligence and energy of these new generations, we will bring those ideals of justice for all, education for all, access, inclusion of all, work at a livable wage, the right to health in a healthy environment into the 2000 years. The circle remains unbroken. In this time, it is with exhilaration and love that I present to you, ladies and gentlemen, sisters and brothers, slackers, hackers, crackers and jackers, a man for all seasons, a man for the right reasons, California Senator Tom Hayden.
Did you just make that up?
Obviously, I did not struggle in the 60s for a plastic badge saying I'm a delegate, and I did not get tear gassed so that I could stay in an air-conditioned room. In fact, as you know, we have bigger problems today than I would have predicted 28 years ago. In 1968, the Kerner Commission predicted that America would become divided along racial lines. It has. Since 1968, the gap between the rich and the poor has become the widest in the industrial world. Poverty has increased. And as the Coalition for the Homeless in Chicago point out, thousands of the homeless are Vietnam veterans. The middle class is shrinking, household income down. People are working a month or more a year for less pay than in 1968. We're building the largest prison system in the Western world, as if we've already decided that nothing really can be done about the younger generation of the inner city. Few of us at the time knew, although we'd read Silent Spring, that our environmental plunder would lead to a degraded planet, shrunken lungs if you live in Los Angeles, spreading cancer elsewhere. And special interest money in campaigns has doubled, if not tripled, in real dollars since 1968. And that is causing a fundamental disenfranchisement of millions of people, and tens of millions of people are simply not voting. So here's the question that really haunts me. Are we, again, now that we have authority, my generation has some authority as parents or politically, are we in the midst of abandoning millions of our own children again? Are we consciously or not deeming them unfit and hopeless? Are we building all these prisons as monuments to our own failures? My grown-up children that you saw earlier today certainly think so. Years. The question today is the same one that was raised by a young college student in 1969 after she visited Chicago during the convention of 1968. She condemned, and I'm quoting her words,
She condemned our prevailing acquisitive and competitive corporate life as not the way of life for us, unquote. And she asked, is this all there is, all we have to look forward to? That speaker was Hillary Rodham, our future First Lady. And I hope she finds an answer to that question in a second term. In looking for that answer, I think the past can be a really powerful resource in looking forward. And that is why the past is so often hidden to us. We can learn from 1968 that change is always possible in the worst of times, but also that no change is ever possible unless individuals stand up, speak out, no fear, no concern for reputation or their neck. No matter how great the apathy, no matter how compromised the times, we must have an optimism of the will. We must teach our children well.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the Reverend Jesse Jackson.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, distinguished Congressman from the 2nd Congressional District of Chicago, Congressman Jesse Jackson, Jr. Years ago, we struggled. The struggle between the moral center and the political center. Vanity asked the question, is it popular? Is it acceptable? Politics asked the question, will it work? What do the polls say? Morality asked the question, is it right? And we who fought to abolish slavery, or for women's suffrage, or for the right of unions to organize, or for civil rights, or to end the war, we embrace the moral center. And the moral center must forever be embraced and not let go. And so it is we have this burden of trying to reconcile the moral center and the political center. Today we come with the need to keep fighting that battle. We must take our party and our nation in another direction. We must embrace protest. Protest is the lifeblood of democracy. The right to fight for the right is in the best tradition of what makes America strong and better. And so the politicians in Montgomery did not change America. Rosa Parks and Dr. King, a man who said better that we walk in dignity than ride in chains. Protesters open up democracy. In 1964, Fannie Lou Hamer did not have prime time. She was prime time. The moral center helped to change the course of our country. Those who fought to end the war laid the predicate for nuclear disarmament and stopped nuclear testing. Those who embrace the moral center, though you may be in the minority and scorned and sometimes isolated, we must never give up the moral center. We must stop playing game with welfare. Most people who are poor are not on welfare. They work every day. They clean clothes. They drive cabs. They change beds in hotels. They work every day. Most poor people are not on welfare. They work every day. Most poor people are not black. They're white and female and two-thirds of children. Let's fight for the mothers. Let's fight for daycare and jobs. Daycare and jobs to stabilize our families. When When we all be arguing about black and white, when they close the plant, when they close Zenith and take it to Maquiladora, when they take the shoe industry from Northeast to Indonesia, there was in South Korea and Taiwan, they were making $5 a day. Now the Indonesia, they make $2.40 a day. On the China, where they make 50 cents a day. Using that Pacific Rim as a vast sucking sound undercutting our living standard. We're over here fighting black and white when the issue is wrong and right. When they close the plant gate down and cut the lights out, black and white look amazing, similar in the dark. The issue is not black and white, it's wrong and right. We must fight the greed. Lastly, we do have political choices, sometimes tough. The toughest people make the toughest choices, and they make smart choices. Dr. King chose Kennedy over Nixon, but neither ran on the public accommodations platform. That came out of Birmingham, not out of Washington. Dr. King chose Johnson over Goldwater. Neither ran on the voting rights platform. That came out of Selma. But there's a choice between Clinton and Dole. I will not stand by and not fight and look at a Dole, Gingrich, Trent Lott, Clarence Thomas, Scalia arrangement. We got to fight back. We got to fight back. At least when we fight, we can expand our choices. When we fight, we can expand our choices. 1968, it was warfare that divided us as we struggled. Now it's welfare. But then in our struggle in 1968, as we struggle without the capacity to reconcile, in our anguish and anger, and we all feel good about the positions we took, the bottom line, when the ship wrecked, Nixon became the president. So now there's another tension today. This time the ship and its passengers must be spared, even to fight for another day. I do not like the signing of this welfare bill, but I will not give up the ship. We cannot give up the ship. The issue is more than Clinton versus Dole. It's a new Congress. I choose Gephardt over Newt Gingrich. I choose Charlie Rangel and Maxine Waters and Lynn Woolsey and Henry Gonzalez, that we can elect a new Congress and affect the president's behavior. We cannot let Dole appoint Supreme Court justices and give Clarence Thomas and Scalia a companion. We can make tough political choices. And they are just that.
And you're listening to The Nation Benefit, held yesterday here in Chicago. Jesse Jackson, Tom Hayden, Alfre Woodard, Studs Terkel, and many others.
After that Jesse Jackson speech, I felt, well, we could just leave now, because that basically said it all.
1968 warfare, 1996 welfare.
And we can't afford to give up the ship was his take on that whole thing. Victor Novasky joins us now very briefly, as we're almost out of time this morning on Democracy Now! Victor, a very successful event. Victor is publisher, of course, of The Nation magazine. But you're not finished here this week with that benefit yesterday in the McCormick Center.
No, I'm here, and Katrina took off yesterday, but Eric Alterman and Mark Cooper and Bruce Shapiro are here. We're covering the convention. We have our own website, and we're filing daily, and the number for people who want to, if whatever it's called.
It's called an address, Victor.
The address, okay.
Welcome to 1996.
Well, this is, I'm still anchored in 1968 technology, but the address is http://www.thenation.com, And then on Thursday...
And you're going to be doing daily dispatches.
We're
going to
be doing daily dispatches on the website. We're going to be filing for the magazine in addition. And then on Thursday, I'm going to be doing some kind of chat with America Online about Clinton's speech while he's making it and when he finishes. And
so those people who are subscribers to American Online, once you just hook in, you will get that chat with Victor Navasky.
Yes. No flames, huh, Victor? Beautiful event yesterday and for the nation participating in it. 2,000 people. You made a lot of money, probably, what, about $150,000 as a benefit there?
Well, as Werner von Braun used to say, that's not my department.
I see. If it broke even, it's probably a benefit.
We should say that Victor Navasky was a New York Times reporter in 1968 here at the Chicago Convention.
Yes, I followed Larry O'Brien around, who was running the convention and running Hubert Humphrey's campaign. And he had three television sets, and when they showed the cops beating people up in the street, he would turn off the two that showed that and put on the one where they were interviewing people like Richard Goodwin or something like
that. Well, Victor Navasky, I want to thank you for joining us, and thank you for that event. By the way, folks, if you'd like a copy of our program, 1-800-735-0230 is the number to call. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin. Our engineer is Michael Yoshida. We had help today from Errol Maitland and Janice K. Bryant. I'm Amy Goodman with Larry Bensky and Salim Wakil for Democracy Now! Live at the Chicago Democratic National Convention here in Illinois.